In 1929, according to the Surrealists, the United States of America did not exist. So we can imagine their distress 12 years later at the beginning of World War II, when they found themselves in New York City as refugees, geographically as well as culturally displaced. Obviously, the Surrealists seeking asylum in the US were relieved to find that it did exist. Several members of the group even ended up staying, creating new lives and careers in the Americas, while some had already established ties either in the US or Mexico. The history of the Surrealists in America is made up of many individual stories, as well as broad cultural exchange and reciprocal discovery. It is a history that I've been engaged with for some time, in my own work and in my role as an editor of the Journal of Surrealism in the Americas, or JSA. Our mission as an international interdisciplinary electronic journal has been to promote a broad range of scholarship devoted to the Surrealist presence and legacy in the Americas. We've published 9 issues since my colleague at Arizona State University, Claudia Mesh, and I co-founded the journal in 2007. So I'd like to take a moment to thank the Terra Foundation for the generous grant, which enabled us not only to start the journal, but to organize a conference at Arizona State University in 2006 on the topic of Surrealism and the American West. Claudia and I were motivated by the fact that while most histories of Surrealism and America up to that time had centered on New York City, it seems pretty evident that if asked to redraw this map after their experiences in America, the Surrealists would probably still exclude New York City. However, they might insert a little bit of the American Southwest and Northwest Coast. For true to the spirit of the original map, it was only the cultures of the indigenous populations and the vastness of the Western landscapes that held any real interest for Surrealism. And this photograph of artists in exile taken at Peggy Guggenheim's home in New York City indexes this fact with the inclusion of the Kachina doll at far right. From the American point of view, the Surrealist presence in New York during the early 1940s was a rich and exciting time. It was the New World discovering the old. Peggy Guggenheim's Art of the Century Gallery, publications in View magazine, the first Papers of Surrealism exhibition, the journal VVV, and a bunch of young American artists embracing Surrealist automatism and transforming it into abstract expressionism. However, from the Surrealist viewpoint, these years were quite different. I want to focus on 2 members of the movement in particular, the leader, André Breton, and his colleague, the artist Max Ernst. For Breton, these were some of the most difficult years of his life. He did not want to leave France and did so only out of desperation. After spending months in Marseille awaiting passage and a long, difficult voyage, first to Martinique, he finally arrived in New York City in July 1941 and spent the next 4 years attempting to cultivate Surrealism on alien soil. These years were marked by a loss of country, friends and colleagues, of his own position at the center of a vibrant cultural movement, and of his wife, Jacqueline, who left him and married the American sculptor, David Hare. New York may have been the location of Surrealist activity, but it did not offer a center in the way of Paris. It lacked the cafe life, the sense of community so central to the Surrealist enterprise. As Ernst said in an interview, in New York we had artists, but not art. Art is not produced by one artist, but by several. There is more loneliness, more isolation among artists than in France. This perspective seems to belie all the evidence of group activity, the group photos, journals, and exhibitions, and points to a very different atmosphere. The most exciting discovery New York had to offer Breton and Ernst were the works of Native American art they found in the antique and curio shops that they frequented with their new friend, anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss. Breton and Lévi-Strauss met on the voyage to America. Led in on Ernst's discovery of Julius Carlbach's shop on 3rd Avenue, they became enthusiastic patrons. Carlbach became a sort of unofficial broker for George High, the director of the Museum of the American Indian in New York, and many objects from his warehouses ended up in the collections of Breton and Ernst. Full disclosure, my entry point into a discussion of French Surrealism and the American West is through a German. So despite the fact that Ernst was a founding member and integral part of the Parisian-based Surrealist, that he spent most of his adult life in France and died a French citizen. His fascination with the art and culture of Native Americans was informed by his childhood in Germany. Brought up on the books of Karl May, Ernst told biographer Patrick Wahlberg that as a child, he pretended that the woods outside his hometown in Brühl were full of Iroquois and Mohicans. His son Jimmy cited that the one thing that was passed down to him from his father's childhood was a 19th century book on North American Indians. Ernst's childhood enthusiasm remained dormant until brought close to the source. Amongst the surrealists in Paris, Breton and Paul Éluard were the collectors of tribal art, not Ernst. As the size of Alaska on the 1920 map indicates, the surrealists respected Inuit art as much as that of Oceania and Africa. In 1931, when Éluard and Breton auctioned off a large part of their collections, these did include many Northwest Coast carvings, Inuit masks, and Breton even owned a Kachina doll or two. But for Ernst, the passion for collecting was really catalyzed during a cross-country road trip that he took with Peggy Guggenheim and his son in the summer of 1941, soon after his arrival in New York. After a visit to California, they rented a car and drove back via the Grand Canyon. There, Ernst purchased the entire stock of Kachina dolls at the Grand Canyon Trading Post. All of them. These he proudly displayed back in Guggenheim's apartment in New York. In the following years, he left Guggenheim, married American artist Dorothea Tanning, and moved to Sedona, Arizona. He lived there for about 10 years before finally returning to France. For both Ernst and Breton, their discovery or rediscovery of Native American art and culture offered them a conduit for a type of cultural integration. It was a way to connect their past and present lives and to reestablish their sense of place. Ernst took this the farthest, creating a new identity for himself as a type of shaman-like figure, building a house in Sedona, Arizona, and, as I've argued elsewhere, playing Indian as a way to naturalize his alien status. While Breton decidedly did not attempt to go native in the way that Ernst did, his interest in Native American culture did expand beyond collecting. On his journey back from Reno in 1945 to get a quick divorce and remarriage, Breton visited several Hopi reservations and witnessed rituals such as the snake dance. Breton's travels in the West formed the physical and psychological backdrop for his poem, Ode to Charles Foyer. He wrote regarding this poem that, quote, between the beginning and the end of the poem must be read in time the trip I made before returning to New York through Nevada, Arizona, and New Mexico, motivated essentially by the intense interest I have in the Indians, the Pueblos in particular. The destiny that has been the lot of these men and their impressive dignity constituted a base for my dreaming, a canvas on which the personality of Charles Foyer was destined to imprint itself in full relief. Breton connected Foyer's ideals of socialist utopia in harmony with the natural world to the Hopi communities of the Southwest. Ernst and Breton were strongly affected through contact with the people as well as the art of these communities. That said, neither Breton nor Ernst approached Native American art or culture from an anthropological perspective. Despite their friendship with Levi Strauss, neither had the extent of practical knowledge shown by their colleagues, Kurt Seligman and Wolfgang Pauen, both of whom, it could be argued, achieved the status of amateur anthropologists. Breton and Ernst viewed the objects they collected as art and had little concern with their authenticity or history. They were interested in these objects as the products of living cultures, evidence of the primitive as a viable possibility in the modern world. Levi Strauss made note of the difference between his own anthropological perspective and Breton's more aesthetic viewpoint. Levi Strauss writes that before he met Breton, he was never interested in modern pieces meant for the tourist trade. They offered no anthropological value. But for Breton, historical or cultural authenticity was irrelevant to the aesthetic power of the work. He viewed these objects as living works of art, giving evidence of the continuing power of the primal mind, of the unconscious, of universality, of the modern power of myth. This did influence Levi Strauss. In an article written for the Gazette des Beaux-Arts in 1943, The Art of the Northwest Coast at the American Museum of Natural History, He strongly celebrates the artistic merits of the objects and peppers his essay with references to European culture, including the art of Picasso and Baudelaire's theory of poetic correspondences. It is significant that all three displaced intellectuals, Levi-Strauss, Ernst, and Breton, were engaged in attempts to establish affinities between Native American art and myth and the Western European tradition with which they were so familiar. Breton's Ode to Foyer connects French socialist philosophy with the pueblos of the Southwest, and Breton frames the poem within the temporal and geographic space of his Western travels. In a similar way, Max Ernst's painting, Europe After the Rain II, combines references to classical mythology in the Rape of Europa and Christianity in the reference to the flood within the backdrop of the current war in Europe and the American Southwestern landscape. By including the dates 1940 to 42, he also establishes a temporal and geographic framework, presenting this work as a document of two journeys, the first from Europe to America and the second from the Western US back to the East. In both Breton's poem and Ernst's painting, the West emerges as a sign of hope for the rebuilding of civilization on the ruins of the old. Many authors, including myself, have placed Breton and Ernst's passion for Native American art during these years in the context of their feelings of alienation and displacement. But arguing for affinities between the modern artist, particularly the surrealist, and the indigenous artist, they sought for more than a way to establish significant psychological connection with their new home. They were also searching for a way to come to terms with the disaster engulfing Europe. There is something therapeutic for both of them in their celebratory embrace of all things Native American and belief in a transcendent primitivism. While Max Ernst did not start avidly collecting Native American art until he moved to America, and there is little evidence of his interest in tribal art or culture in his Dada or Surrealist works of the 1920s and 30s, that is not to say that he wasn't thoroughly indoctrinated into the rhetoric of primitivism. And while he might not have brought his childhood enthusiasm for American Indians to the nascent Surrealists in Paris in 1922, he did bring a detailed knowledge of the psychoanalytic theories of Sigmund Freud. So while Ernst had never embraced primitivism as a style, such as the German Expressionists, he viewed it as a quality of the unconscious mind. Among the psychoanalytic texts that he was conversant with was Freud's 1918 study, Totem and Taboo. We know that this work was on his mind in 1941. In Freud's Totem and Taboo, he stresses the connection between the unconscious of the modern individual and the thought processes of so-called primitive peoples, whether ancient or modern. Freud claimed the unconscious to be an atavistic space where the ancient mind still held sway. By tapping into these thought processes, by allowing free rein to the unconscious, the Surrealists felt a kinship with minds unfettered by Western industrial demands for rational efficiency and positivistic science. Specific to this kinship were psychic mechanisms Freud termed condensation and displacement. One of the things Freud does in Totem and Taboo is establish a kinship between these mechanisms and certain types of analogical thinking attributed to primitive peoples. The terminology here gets a little baroque, but basically Freud borrowed heavily from the writings of anthropologists such as J.G. Frazier in his popular text, The Golden Bough. Freud adopted Frazier's definition of animism as a form of primal thought that entails a projection of one's own mental functioning onto the objective world. Freud terms this the omnipotence of thought and continues and considers it to be a quality of primitive peoples, children, and the mentally ill. In his discussion of animism, Frazier defines sympathetic magic as a practice in which imitation and contagion are put into play. Imitation relies on the similarity between the act performed and the result expected. Contagion perceives these associations through spatial proximity. Freud rewrites these mechanisms and compares them to condensation and displacement, respectively, the actions performed by the unconscious in transforming repressed content into accessible forms. In the interpretation of dreams, he defines condensation and displacement as part of the dream work and describes their visual effects. Early in his career, Ernst adopted these mechanisms as a structure for the creation of images. Condensation entails the visual superimposition of one form upon another based on shared qualities, while displacement stimulates a sort of visual metamorphosis from one form to another based on proximity. I want to argue two things. Rather than romantic or naive, Ernst and Breton thoroughly subscribed to a type of transcendent primitivism grounded, ironically, in the scientific thinking of their time, in which modern artistic rhetoric, visual and poetic, shared ancestry with ancient tribal and unconscious functions of thought. And secondly, these shared functions established connections between the individual psyche and the larger environment and community through the mechanisms of displacement and condensation. Displacement activated a type of reciprocal projection from the psyche to the environment. Condensation allowed for multiple forms of unity to coexist, to unify and coexist. An example of the prevalence of both these mechanisms in the work of Ernst and Breton in America is their explorations into the creation of myths and fantasies of mimesis. A year after arriving in New York, Breton published the Prolegomena to a Third Manifesto of Surrealism, or ELSE, in the first issue of the New Surrealist publication VVV. In this text, he answered, or Triple V, in this text, he answers his own call for the need for a new myth by providing one, the myth of the great invisibles. He writes, quote, "Man is perhaps not the center, the focus of the universe. One may go so far as to believe that there exist above him, on the animal level, beings whose behavior is as alien to him as his own must be to the mayfly or the whale. There is nothing that would necessarily prevent such beings from completely escaping his sensory frame of reference, since these beings might avail themselves of a type of camouflage, which, no matter how one imagines it, becomes plausible when one considers the theory of form and what has been discovered about mimetic animals." He goes on to postulate that these beings obscurely manifest themselves to us in fear and the feelings of chance, and ends by asking, "A new myth? These beings, must they be convinced that they derive from a mirage, or should they be given an opportunity to reveal themselves?" There is a strong correlation between Breton's text and the mimetic rock formations in Ernst's paintings from these years, such as in The Eye of Silence. Both Ernst's art and Breton's myth owe a debt to the writings of Roger Caillois, specifically his article, Mimeticism, a Psychasthenie Legendaire, published in Minotaur in 1935. In this text, Caillois posits a fundamental correspondence between the biological camouflage of certain insects, animistic magic, and modern psychosis. He interprets psychasthenia as a spatial confusion affecting the distinction between an individual and the surrounding environment that results in a type of disillusion or loss of self. The mimetic insects and foliage of Ernst's jungle paintings, such as Joy of Life from 1936, appear to be a direct response to Caillois' text. Ernst features the quintessential mimetic animal, the praying mantis, in exuberant images of reciprocal imitation between flora and fauna. However, Caillois writes of animal mimicry in terms of loss and the death drive. He only considers the possibility of the animate mimicking the inanimate, identity literally becoming displaced into the environment. Breton does frame his myth of the great invisibles as a desire to decenter the human ego and suggests that these great beings only manifest themselves to us in fear. Breton, of course, does not conceive of the great invisibles as supernatural beings. For him, the source of myth, of anxiety, of chance, of that which displaces the ego, is the human unconscious. Both Ernst and Breton reinterpret Caillois, allowing for the animation of the inanimate as well. They allow for the projection of the individual unconscious out onto the environment, not necessarily to lose identity, but to establish psychic identity with the environment. Ernst's landscapes function as projections of the artist's unconscious onto a new environment, specifically for Ernst, the rock formations of the American Southwest. The mythic power of Breton's great invisibles seem to reveal themselves, as he suggests, from a mirage, which is, of course, a hallucination brought on by the desert heat. Possibly the great invisibles reveal themselves within the mimetic rock formations of the southwest or the carved totem poles of the northwest. Ernst began Europe After the Rain in 1940 and finished it in 1942 after his first trip out west. During this trip, he supposedly experienced a moment of objective chance when he first viewed the rock formations near Sedona. His son writes that his father got out of the car and stood transfixed. Quote, he was staring at the very same fantastic landscape that he had repeatedly painted in Ardèche, France, not very long ago, without knowing of its actual existence. That one look was to change the future of his life in America. While this may be a myth perpetuated by his son, it does serve to create a psychic connection between Ernst and Sedona, the place he chose to live, for almost 10 years. And there is a sense of continuity between the landscapes Ernst was working on in France before the war and those he either completed or produced in America. This continuity depends somewhat on the use of the technique of decalcomania, a process by which he presses paint on the canvas using either a glass plate or just folding and unfolding the canvas like a Rorschach test. According to Ernst, the resulting textures and patterns provoke his visual facilities and suggest various landscape formations. I want to complicate this instance of objective chance by suggesting that the recognition of mimetic rock formations may have been triggered by Ernst's familiarity with the French scientific journal La Nature. This illustrated journal, which ran from 1873 until 1962, would have been one of the sources the Surrealists had for information concerning current and popular ethnography, as well as images of the American West and Native American art and culture. La Nature even published an article on Kurt Seligman and the Matt Totem Pole that he brought to the Musée de l'Homme in 1939. Ernst had favored the engraved illustrations found in outdated issues of this journal as source materials for the collages and collage novels he produced during the 1920s and 1930s. As I was looking at some of the issues that Ernst mined for source materials, I found it interesting that La Nature had a reoccurring feature from 1891 to 1895 on Les Roches à Figure Animée. For example, an 1893 issue includes natural formations in Colmar and Thessaly which resemble sphinxes. A sphinx-like figure is a staple feature of Ernst's American landscapes. Therefore, one could postulate that it was not the specific forms of the rock formations that resonated so strongly for Ernst, but their mimetic possibilities. Whatever magical power Ernst found in the animistic rock formations of Sedona, Breton found in the impressive Rocher Percé of the Gaspé Peninsula in Canada, and while granted this doesn't have the same mimetic potential as the rock formations of Arizona, it is rather impressive and has been likened to the form of a ship under sail. Max Ernst and André Breton found that if Surrealism had a place in America, it was not to be in New York, but in the most remote places they could find. Breton's experience in America turned a corner after he met Elisa Claro in 1943. He traveled with her to the Gaspé Peninsula in 1944, where they stayed for several months. Then in 1945, they undertook their journey to Reno, visiting Hopi and Zuni villages in Arizona and New Mexico on their return. Before leaving for France, they stopped in Haiti. And in an excerpt from a speech he made to a group of young Haitian poets, Breton states, quote, that in the essential development of Surrealism, which has consisted of making heard the interior voice within each human being, we have found ourselves linked from the beginning with primitive thought. In periods of great social and moral crises, I believe it is indispensable that we inquire into primitive thought to rediscover the fundamental aspirations, the incontestably authentic aspirations of mankind. Unquote. The lasting impact of the American West was a conviction that Surrealism found a place within the struggles of the oppressed, so-called primitive peoples, and the desire to create an alternative modernity in the modern world. That the displaced within society were maybe the only ones who could claim a sense of place in the more significant sense.